The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello, everyone. This is your producer for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, Sam Livingston. Obviously filling in here today for Mr. Stephen Fleury, who's in Edmond for the Ministerial Conference. I'll just go ahead and hop right into the subject today. We're hearing a lot over the past 2 years about Robert Mueller's special counsel. Mr. Stephen Fleury has gotten into the details, the nitty-gritty details of this investigation. He's been going over it for months now, so I want to keep away from all of those details that he's already covered, but I want to get more into the law and the thinking and the theory behind what even is a special counsel. What is all of this about, and how did America get to the point that it's in? Are these prosecutors unhinged? Are they out of control? We're still waiting for the crime to actually be defined. Is this counsel that Mueller is conducting, is it constitutional? Or is it just a politically motivated investigation? We obviously know that it's been very successful at one thing, and that's dividing America. It's also been very successful at irritating President Trump. The president has called this investigation a hoax. He has called it a witch hunt. And he's gotten a lot of criticism for that. Well, why would you talk about, you know, this independent investigation this way? And there's a lot of truth to the president's tweets, calling this a hoax and a witch hunt. And we'll get into that a little later or more towards the end of the show about what's behind more of Mueller's special counsel. But we're constantly hearing about this. Mueller, he's just saving it up. He's got this bombshell report that's going to come out any day now. But we're ignoring a lot of the bigger questions. A lot of these broader questions aren't being answered. Is this really justice? Is it legal to be investigating the president if we haven't actually defined what the crime is? Is this investigation ethical, considering how political it is? Would you, as a private citizen, like to be investigated by people who are out to get you? So on the show today, we're going to take a look at the history of these special counsels, how this institution came to, well, I shouldn't even call it an institution, how these investigations came to exist. Is it constitutional? How is it being used today? How is it that Robert Mueller appears to be the most powerful man in the United States of America? And by the end of the show, hopefully we'll be able to get into more of defining what Mueller's special counsel is, how it came to be, and really what we're witnessing today. It's out of control. The complexities are so intricate. It really shouldn't be that way. But it's an illustration of just how lawless, how political, how politically motivated our justice system has become. And I think this history will provide a lot of interesting context to what we're witnessing today. We need this history to give us that context so we can better grasp what we're witnessing today. I'd like to just set up with a couple of quotes from Mr. Fleury's a couple of his recent articles where he has been incredibly strong about what's happening here with the deep state, with these investigations into the Trump campaign and the president of the United States. This is from his article, Saving America from the Radical Left Temporarily. This is from May 2018, the Trumpet magazine, May 2018. He says, "The entire Trump-Russia investigation is based on a hoax. Robert Mueller's team has been searching for evidence of collusion for nearly a year and has found nothing. But what has been revealed is a tremendous amount of lawbreaking by bureaucrats and intelligence and law enforcement. The previous president filled America's law enforcement agencies with treasonous agents. He led what is known as the deep state. Something diabolical was going on until Mr. Trump was elected, and it is still going on behind the scenes during his presidency. Later on in that article, he says, "Our Constitution makes America different from any nation in the world. The protections afforded by the Constitution have allowed God to bless this nation tremendously. They prevent a dictator from seizing control of the nation's unmatched resources, resources that God gave in order to fulfill promises he made to the patriarch Abraham." So a lot of this, a lot of what Mr. Fleury is hitting on, it's about law. It's about lawlessness. And really where this conversation in the United States, what we should be looking back on for the United States, these are unconverted people, what is the law? What do we look back on? It's the Constitution. So where we begin is the Constitution. And what this big question about a special counsel and the legality of it, really we should be looking at what the foundational law says. Article 2, Section 1, it says, "The executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States." Plain and simple. The president is responsible for enforcing the laws. That is the power that his branch is given. Article 2, Section 3 of the Constitution. "He, the president, shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. It is the president's job solely to make sure the law is executed." And this is the context of what we're looking at today. When we talk about the deep state, this is something occurring under the president in the executive branch of government and his Department of Justice. And that Department of Justice is responsible for enforcing the law. And then the president appoints the head of the Department of Justice. During Barack Obama's time, that was Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch. For President Trump, it was Jeff Sessions and soon to be William Barr. But his Department of Justice is responsible for enforcing the law. The Department of Justice has prosecutors. I'll just call it the DOJ. It has prosecutors, and their job is to go out and serve pretty much as lawyers of the government. They go out, they find the lawbreakers, and they take them to court. They take them before a judge to prosecute them for breaking the law. Now, these departments, these sub-departments of the executive branch have grown out of control. They are tremendously huge. There is just an innumerable number of these three-letter acronyms that we hear about in the news today. So it has gone far beyond its size. But basically, what it comes down to is this department is there to enforce the laws that Congress has made. And this big question revolves around, well, what happens when someone in the executive branch, and this includes anybody in the DOJ, anyone in the FBI, what happens when someone in that department does something wrong? Who investigates the people responsible for upholding the law? Now, the framers intended this to be Congress. They have oversight. They can start investigative committees. They have judicial committees. They have the power to impeach. And we really, a lot of this begins to get conflated and confusing right back at Watergate. If you look back to this history of Watergate is where we can get a lot of the context for what's happening today. A lot of the division in Washington, D.C. can be traced back to this episode. And great again, Mr. Fleury says, "In 1974, U.S. President Nixon resigned from office over the Watergate scandal. It was discovered that the Nixon administration had broken into the Democratic National Committee headquarters and tried to cover it up. Many Americans these days know little about what happened at Watergate. To them, it is a scandal that brought down a corrupt president. But there is much more to the story." Mr. Fleury says, "What happened at that time has a lot to do with what we see today." He's talking about the lawless prosecutors that went after President Nixon. So let's briefly just look back at what happened here at Watergate. And there was a lot of corruption on the part of those who were prosecuting President Nixon and his campaign team. And that's something we often don't hear about. You know, at the end of the story, Nixon resigns, but the prosecutors, they go unpunished. They are incentivized. They are rewarded for behaving the way that they did. I don't have a ton of time to get into it, but that section in Great Again is really interesting about how the prosecutors, they colluded with the judges in a lot of these trials. They took evidence out of context. They misrepresented evidence in order to get the decisions they wanted. Today, what we're witnessing, Mr. Fleury says, Watergate is trivial compared to the lawlessness of today's radical left. So today, it's hundreds of times worse than it was back then. But back then, we're looking at, again, where this started. So briefly summarizing the Watergate scandal, there's a lot of leaking going on about America's military operations, I think in Vietnam and Cambodia. And these reports are being leaked to the press. And now President Nixon, he's up for re-election. I think this is 1972. And they're trying to figure out where these government leaks are coming from. These are illegal leaks. It's harmful to the country. It's obviously hurting Nixon to have these leaks going on. And that's why there was this break-in at the Watergate Hotel. Nixon's campaign team dispatched the plumbers to go and find the leak and to fix them, to break into the DNC to find where the leaks were coming from. Now, obviously, this break-in was indisputable. It was illegal to trespass, to go into the DNC the way that they did. You could make an argument, though, that this was in the interest of national security to find where these leaks were coming from. The big scandal then turns on to whether or not Nixon authorized or knew about the break-in. Did the President of the United States tell those men to go in there and do this? And then now this is what's being investigated. Initially, the investigation is carried out by the federal office where the crime occurred, where the break-in occurred. So it's not being handled by the upper echelon of the Department of Justice. Is being handled by a lower district, and they're doing their job, carrying out this investigation. Robert Bork, who we've heard a lot about, he is present through all of this. He's working in the Nixon administration, and he writes this article. This is 20 years after the fact. In 1993, he writes an article that we'll get more into the title a little later, but for now, the title of it is Against the Independent Counsel, and this is from February 1st, 1993. He says, the initial investigation of the break-in at the Watergate complex was conducted by Earl Silbert and his colleagues in the Office of the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia. So the Office of the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia. It's at a lower level. The facts unearthed caused Silbert to order research on the constitutionality of indicting the president before he was removed from office by conviction on impeachment. I'll just skip forward a little bit further here. Silbert and his colleagues were ready to make the case against Nixon and his aides, but Elliot Richardson had just been nominated by Nixon for the post of Attorney General. So President Nixon is trying to fill the position at the head of the Department of Justice. Bork continues, and the Senate Judiciary Committee conditioned confirmation on Richards' agreement to appoint a special prosecutor. So in other words, Nixon appoints this man to be the Attorney General. The Senate says, we're only going to confirm him if he says he's going to open a special investigation, if he's going to appoint a special prosecutor to investigate the president. So it's a Democrat-controlled Senate at the time. Richardson gets approved, and then he appoints this special prosecutor. And he chose his old law school professor. This is Bork continuing on. He chose his old law school professor, Archibald Cox. Silbert gave Cox about 90 typewritten pages outlining the conspiracy and the evidence, More work remained to be done, but the essential outline of the case was there. Watergate would have played out the way it did had the U.S. Attorney's Office been allowed to continue. So what Bork is saying is this lower-level district was carrying out the investigation. They were doing their job. They had dozens and dozens of pages written up about it. There was no need to appoint a special prosecutor at this high level. However, Nixon's opposition, they were out for blood. They wanted this investigation. They were focused on getting Nixon. So what happens, Nixon appoints this attorney general. Obviously, he needs to be confirmed by the Senate. But then the attorney general appoints as the Mueller of this time a man named Archibald Cox. So Archibald Cox, he is the Robert Mueller of the Watergate scandal. Continuing on from Bork's article, he says, although Cox was a man of integrity and ability, Richardson made a mistake in naming him special prosecutor. Nixon was immediately convinced that the investigation would be partisan because Cox was a longtime ally of Nixon's despised and feared political enemy, Senator Edward Kennedy. To compound matters, Cox made the politically maladroit move of taking the oath of office with the Kennedy family in attendance. The newspaper accounts and photographs of that event magnified White House paranoia. So Nixon is, he's shivering right now because, well, you're telling me this man's going to be given power to investigate me and he is a friend of one of my greatest political enemies? You know, this investigation is supposed to appear bipartisan. It's not supposed to appear political. That's the whole point. So Nixon is scared. He's nervous because this man, Archibald Cox, he's going to be out to get me. And then this is what eventually leads to what we hear a lot about today, is this event known as the Saturday Night Massacre. And that's a very dramatic way to describe someone being fired. That's the leftist media for you. So Nixon says, look, I'm in control of the Department of Justice. This is my branch of government. I want Archibald Cox fired. Now, the problem here is he cannot get to Archibald Cox. If you think of this in a hierarchy, you've got Nixon at the top, you've got his attorney general below him, and then you have Archibald Cox, or the Mueller of that time. So in order to fire Cox, Nixon has to fire his attorney general, or he can direct his attorney general to fire him. So that's what Nixon does. He says, he pretty much arranges it in a way where he's telling his attorney general, there's more details to it than I have time to get into. He's setting it up in a way where he says to his attorney general, I want you to fire this man. The attorney general refuses. Nixon says, okay, you're gone. Then he tells his deputy attorney general, you fire him. He refuses. Okay, you're gone. Finally, it gets down to Robert Bork, who is the solicitor general. So it goes three people down the line. These two guys get fired. And then Robert Bork says, the president told me to fire you. I'm firing you. Now, this just set off the media. He's obstructing justice. He's trying to stop the investigation. He doesn't want us looking at something. And what Robert Bork is complaining about, he's very upset after this. He says, well, first of all, I'm just doing what the president instructed me to do. The president is not saying stop the investigation. He knows the investigation is coming. He is allowing it to happen, but he wants a prosecution, not a persecution. So he says, get Archibald Cox out. And then Robert Bork appoints Leon Jaworski. And then you'll hear about that name after the investigation. So no one below him was fired. The investigation wasn't stopped. Nixon was just afraid of his political opponent essentially leading the investigative arm of his Department of Justice against him. I've got this soundbite here. This is from Robert Bork. This is an interview from 1973, right after this Saturday Night Massacre.
Mr. Bork, your predecessor, Elliot Richardson, resigned. So did William Ruckelshaus. What persuaded you that you could go ahead and fire Archibald Cox?
Had I thought for one moment that in firing Mr. Cox, I would jeopardize those investigations and prosecutions in any way, I would not have done so, but I was confident that that was not the case, and it is proved not to be the case. Those investigations and prosecutions are going forward as before with full vigor.
There was a great deal of talk about Congress wanting a court-appointed prosecutor. I think you've said this is unconstitutional, but there is a bill in the Senate now. Does this bother you?
Yes, it does bother me, because I think if the prosecution function is lodged by law outside the executive branch and perhaps in the courts, that it may turn out, I think it will turn out, to be unconstitutional, and that would seem to me to put these investigations and prosecutions in great danger, and that's the last thing I think we want to do.
So Bork is saying these investigations will continue. No one said that it would stop. All I did was obey the orders of the president, and we put a new special prosecutor in there. We put a new Mueller in there. Now, at the time, obviously this goes on. There's a lot of chaos, a lot more details I don't have time to get into. You can read more about that chapter in the book, in Mr. Fleury's book, Great Again. If you want even more detail, you can read Jeff Shepard's book, The Real Watergate Scandal. But now, after Watergate, we enter into this debate. Well, how do we investigate the president? We can't use his own Department of Justice to turn on him, to investigate him. That is breaking the separation of powers. It's his branch. You can't take his branch and turn it against him. And after this, they're trying to figure out, well, let's introduce this thing called an independent counsel. And what they want to do is say, Congress, if they feel like they need to appoint someone, they can appoint an independent counsel, and that independent counsel now leads an investigation against the president. The problem with this is that that person is essentially given all of the power of the attorney general, which is a position appointed by the president. He's given all of that power, but he's not appointed by the president. He's not answerable to the president. He's not answerable to the attorney general. So can Congress step into the executive branch this way? Now, you can go back and forth all day about, well, what if the president's wrong? How do we investigate the president? The main question that you have to answer is it constitutional? Are you allowed to do that? It isn't a perfect system. It's not going to stop everything. But who's to decide if you can do this or cannot? Now, the Federalist Society, they put together this awesome video. I've probably watched it four or five times now. It's called The Great Dissent, Justice Scalia's Opinion and Morrison versus Olson. And I'll get more into that in just a second here, but I have a clip that I want to play for you from them.
Post-Watergate, they had just gone through the Nixon presidency, and there was a widespread, even bipartisan, sense that you couldn't trust the president to investigate himself or his highest-ranking subordinates.
The conclusion that emerged out of Watergate was we need a system in which an experienced prosecutor has enough independence that the president can't just turn around and fire that person.
Congress introduced by statute in the Ethics in Government Act an alternative mechanism for policing what it saw as the prospect of executive malfeasance.
A panel of judges would appoint a special prosecutor, called in this case an independent counsel, to investigate the activities of the person in the executive branch whose conduct was being questioned.
So what they're explaining there is a little bit of what I said just before the clip. Congress will appoint this man to do this investigation. Now, they tried to get this passed right after Watergate. It didn't go through, and it wasn't until 1978, and Jimmy Carter is president. He decides to push this statute through, and it's called the Ethics in Government Act of 1978. And this is what creates the independent counsel. This is what makes it, quote-unquote, legal. Now, Carter, he says, well, we have to do this. Look at Watergate. This is just the right thing to do. He gets some lawyers to write this up for him. Everything is done at his direction, and his lawyers are really nervous about this bill. They or this act. Is it constitutional? Is this legal? And what they did was in it they put a sunset clause, and what that means is we're going to push this through now, but in another 10 years it's going to be up for a vote, and we can decide then after seeing it for 10 years, do we really want this? After those lawyers got out of Carter's administration, they were writing letters to the Supreme Court saying, knock this down. This is not constitutional. So there's a lot of little details, again, that you could get into, but essentially these lawyers had the foresight to see what could become of a bill like this, what you could unleash if Congress has the power to step in to the executive branch like this. Where does something like that end? And what you're seeing today in the Mueller investigation is probably the extreme, the worst. It's certainly bad. It probably could get even worse. But this is where it's starting. This is kind of Mueller special counsel in its infancy. And really what happened was Ronald Reagan took the brunt of this act. If you look back at his presidency from 81, I believe, to 88 or 89, he's got independent counsels being launched against him left and right. Some of them lasted 10 years. He had, I think he had control of the Senate, or not control, Republican control of the Senate for a little while, maybe 6 of the 8 years, but he didn't have the House of Representatives at all. So the House of Representatives kept firing these independent counsels at President Reagan. Everything was being investigated all the time, and it got very partisan, it got very political, and it made the Republicans despise this act that Carter pushed through. And then finally, someone in Reagan's administration says, I'm tired of this. I am not doing what that special prosecutor tells me to do because what they are doing is unconstitutional. And essentially, this is what came to be known as this awesome Supreme Court case, Morrison versus Olson. Olson is the man who works for Reagan. Morrison is the Congress-appointed special prosecutor. Olson says, I'm not listening to you, Morrison. I'm not doing that. Your office is unconstitutional. I am not going to cooperate. Morrison takes Olson to the Supreme Court. This is happening in 1988. And this, you could do a whole program on this. This is such an interesting case to get into, Morrison versus Olson. But you come out of this, and this is where Antonin Scalia enters the picture, 1987, 1988. And he is a hero of all of this. This is such an awesome episode for Antonin Scalia. He has just been nominated, I think it was a year before, by Reagan. He gets approved. 1988, this is right after the Bork debacle of him being borked and not getting his seat. And then Anthony Kennedy, he is nominated, but he decides, well, I'm too new to the court. I'm going to step off of this Morrison versus Olson case. So you've got 8 judges deciding on this case. And the Supreme Court votes 7-1 in favor of Morrison. And then what this case came down to was the Supreme Court deciding, is the independent counsel unconstitutional or is it constitutional? The Supreme Court, 7-1, decided the independent counsel is constitutional. You can guess who the one dissenting vote is. The one vote who said this is unconstitutional, Antonin Scalia. He's the newest member on the court. He hops right in there and says, I don't care if I have to go against all other 7 justices. This is unconstitutional. These other judges are getting into the weeds of this case. They're getting into very nuanced details, but we need to look at the big picture. We need to think this out. 20, 30 years from now, what happens? What did the founders intend to happen? This is classic Justice Scalia going against the other judges. Yeah, what they say might be right this time, and it certainly sounds right. Sounds like they're going with their gut, but you know, who am I to decide right and wrong? If it's not in the Constitution, I disagree. And he says, no. I agree with Olson. This is unconstitutional. And here is another clip from the video, The Great Dissent.
The big argument is whether or not you could have a special counsel who operated independently of the president, because she could only be removed for very narrowly defined causes. Justice Scalia's dissent today is famous for his very, very strong and powerful rhetoric about that aspect of the case.
The majority opinion written by Chief Justice Rehnquist looked at various different aspects of the independent counsel provisions and said, well, it's not too much power.
It was deliberately structured as a case-specific, fact-specific. You have to look at the particulars of each instance. So it doesn't have the character of what we might call a rule. And this is also one of the reasons why Justice Scalia got so upset about it.
A little bit of erosion here, a little bit of intrusion here. In the totality of circumstances, it's not too bad and it's tolerable. It's the kind of situation that Justice Scalia recoiled from.
I love that line. This is the situation that, the sort of situation that Justice Scalia recoils from. He does not like where these sorts of decisions lead. He says, if you start compromising on this little bit, yeah, it might be unconstitutional, but okay, I'll go with my gut. Scalia says, if you start down that path, it does not stop. And I've been reading through his dissent. It's very long, but what I love about it is it's easy to understand. He's not in all of these details. He looks at the essence of the case, and he looks right to the Constitution. Can we do this? It's very colorful. It's well written. I'm about maybe a third of the way through it. I'll just read a couple of lines. He says, it is not for us to determine, and we have never presumed to determine, how much of the purely executive powers of government must be within the full control of the president. The Constitution prescribes that they all are. So if the Constitution says this, who are we to now come and say it doesn't mean that? He says, once we depart from the text of the Constitution, just where short of that do we stop? He just looked at his job very simply. The Constitution says not to do it, we don't do it. If you want to change that, Congress can pass a law. But this law right now, or they can make an amendment, but this law right now is unconstitutional. So nobody agrees with Scalia. He's outnumbered 7-1. Everyone at the time says, oh, he's crazy. Of course this is constitutional. They loved it then when it was being used to go after Ronald Reagan. But then the Sunset Clause. Oh, this law is up for vote again. Now President George W. Bush is in office. And he's got some investigations going on, and they want to continue those investigations. So they pass the Independent Counsel Act. They renew it for another 10 years. We just want to finish up these investigations into George Bush. Then we get to Clinton in 1992. And the Republicans say, if you wanted to play this game for so long, we'll do it right back to you. Clinton is under investigation almost through the entirety of his presidency. You hear a lot about the Ken Starr investigation. Suddenly, all the Democrats realize this is a horrible, horrible thing. We're constantly under investigation. We can't get anything done. People are being indicted here and there. The press is going wild. This is out of control. And suddenly, we get to 1999. Clinton is nearing the end of his presidency. They've had enough of this law and now decide Scalia was right. Scalia was right. It's unconstitutional. They had to get a taste of their own medicine, so Scalia makes this decision 12 years before. He's all alone, and now the mainstream, everybody, left and right, Justice Scalia was right. It was a heroic move by Scalia, and he was vindicated by this decision. But it wasn't the end. This investigatory power could not just disappear. I just have one more clip from the Federalist Society video that I'd like to play for you.
At the time the decision came down, most people in the academic world, most law professors thought the majority was right, Justice Scalia was wrong. As time has gone by, it's almost a consensus that Justice Scalia was right.
And Scalia, he wasn't going out on a limb there. He wasn't just, well, I want to go against the majority here. He's very well thought out, very well read, very well sourced dissent. It is now kind of in that sense seen as the majority opinion 12 years after the fact. But rather than doing away with the independent counsel, they decide, well, we'll make it a special counsel. So they don't renew the act. Instead, the independent counsel morphs into the special counsel. And this is what we have today, special counsels. And this is essentially why you don't hear a lot of people saying the Mueller investigation is unconstitutional. I will get to that later. I think it's very unethical. But now we're getting into the realm here where we've stopped Congress from appointing a figure to investigating the president to now the counsel being appointed by the president's own Department of Justice. And that's a very different arrangement because now the way it's arranged, that special prosecutor, Mueller in this case, answers to the attorney general who then answers to the president. Congress has now been booted out of it. And this is where we arrive today. We're looking now at Mueller's special counsel. We've gone through Reagan experienced the independent counsel. Clinton experienced it. This is enough. You don't hear a lot about special counsels during the Bush years and the Obama years, and that's because whose Department of Justice is ever going to trigger a special counsel on their own president? Certainly not going to happen during the Obama years. You didn't hear anything about, well, we need a special counsel when the IRS scandal arose over Benghazi. And in fact, you really didn't need it. Congress was doing enough as it was investigating those things. Congress has the power to impeach, and that's the way really the founders wanted it. Now, first of all, today, why have this special counsel? And if you're in the opposition party, if you're the Democrats and you don't have control in the House, you don't have control in the Senate, you've just lost the presidency, well, how do you even get the president's own Department of Justice to trigger a special counsel? In our case today, we're looking at Mueller's special counsel, and this is kind of like a check on the government. The Democrats wanted another check on the government because they knew, well, we don't have the House, we don't have the Senate, we don't have the presidency. We need something to get at him, to get at the president. So we have to figure out how can we trigger a special counsel. This is going to be hard work. He's fired the Obama holdovers, or rather they resigned, Sally Yates, Loretta Lynch. Actually, Sally Yates had to be pushed out. That's beside the fact. President Trump, he appointed Jeff Sessions as attorney general. This is the hierarchy here. President Trump, Jeff Sessions, and then Rod Rosenstein. And you hear about him quite a lot. Now, like I said earlier, the arrangement of the special counsel today might not or isn't strictly unconstitutional. What has to happen is it's more of a transparency issue. Well, the attorney general, you know, the president might look conflicted, so we find someone who isn't a part of the Justice Department and we appoint him to be the investigator. He gathers his own team and they now investigate the president or the members of the executive branch. Mueller did not do a very good job of making that investigation look apolitical or bipartisan. He was Jim Comey's predecessor, and he hired, and you hear a lot about this from, or if you follow the president on Twitter, the 13 angry Democrats. He hired lawyers who had worked for Hillary Clinton as part of his investigative team. He hired Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, both members who were out to get the president. So this does not look apolitical. This is clearly something that is politically driven. But how did this happen? Rod Rosenstein was appointed by President Trump. Why would Rod Rosenstein appoint Robert Mueller to carry out this investigation? Today, President Trump could end this in a heartbeat. He could say to his attorney general, fire Robert Mueller. If the attorney general refuses, he can fire the attorney general, get a new one in there who will obey him, and then you work your way down the line until he gets to firing Mueller. What that would ignite, and this is why you hear so much about this, is the president's version of the Saturday Night Massacre. Oh, the president, he fired his subordinates because they weren't doing what he asked them to do. So the thinking now is, by the Democrats, well, Mr. President, if you're innocent, you really shouldn't fear an investigation. So let's just go ahead and have this. It's for transparency. It'll please the media. Just let this go ahead and happen. If you're President Trump and you're innocent and you say this is a hoax, fine. Go ahead and do it. But if you're not the president and you're someone lower level, like, or someone who's not in the executive branch, like Michael Cohen, or Michael Flynn, or Carter Page, or George Papadopoulos, this is a scary thing. Because you are associated with the president, and you are now being investigated by a very powerful entity. And that is essentially the Department of Justice. Robert Mueller holds the power of the federal government's their prosecuting power. He wields all of this and can hold it against them. There's no limit on his funding. He can just keep spending. So again, now we get to this question. How did Mueller get appointed by Trump's appointee? In short, this comes down to Rod Rosenstein falling into the never Trump category. He is on that spectrum of things. He's a Republican, but he is a staunch never Trumper. The reason the president appointed him was he needed to get his appointments through. In the Senate, because these high-level positions need to be appointed by the Senate, he only had a very slim majority, 51-49, and it was hard to get people approved, especially when you have men like Jeff Flake, who will just side with the Democrats to get their pity. So he's having to find some people who, well, they're Republican on paper, but they don't really, you know, they're not with me the way they should be. So Rod Rosenstein falls into this category. He gets approved by the Senate, and this is very unusual. He's approved by the Senate 94-6. So he's very popular amongst Republicans, and he's very popular amongst Democrats. And Rosenstein likes this. He likes that, you know, he's bipartisan and he's above the fray. So now our hierarchy looks like this. President Trump, Jeff Sessions, Rod Rosenstein. And then below them, you have the FBI, you have Jim Comey and Andrew McCabe. This is where things get weird. And you'll hear about it like this is this chaotic week. Really, when it comes down to it, it was a very calculated week. What led up to the triggering of Mueller's investigation? Rosenstein, he wants to be bipartisan. He's right down the middle. Well, he's taking a look at the way Jim Comey handled the Hillary Clinton investigation. All of the Democrats are upset at Jim Comey. We lost the election because of you. They're all blaming Jim Comey. The Republicans obviously are upset with Jim Comey because he gave Hillary Clinton a free pass. President Trump is upset with Jim Comey because Comey lied to him about being investigated. So everyone's looking at Comey, and then Rosenstein thinks, well, I'll be the hero here, and I'll write this letter of recommendation to the president recommending that he fire Jim Comey. Now, it's important at this time to remember that Jim Comey is the head of the FBI. The FBI is running an investigation into the president. They haven't defined what the crime is. It's all built around the Steele dossier, and Mr. Fleury has gotten into these details before. But Rosenstein says, I'll write this letter, Comey will get fired, everyone will love me. He writes this letter May 9th. He writes his memo to President Trump. On May 9th, 2017, President Trump fires Jim Comey. The way you'll read it written is that Rosenstein miscalculated the way the Democrats would respond. The Democrats were livid. The media exploded. And this honestly was probably not the reaction that they were thinking they would get. It seemed like nobody liked Jim Comey at this time. Suddenly, now it all shifts to President Trump is obstructing justice and he's trying to stop this investigation that Comey is carrying out because he's nervous that the Russians must have something on him. Well, never mind that Rosenstein just wrote this letter recommending that he fire Comey. And it's a very unpredictable mindset of the Democrats. Andrew McCarthy has a well-written and funny piece in National Review. It's titled Rod Rosenstein's Resistance. He says, for years, Rosenstein had carefully tended to his reputation as an apolitical lawman, beloved of both parties. At a time when Trump nominees for top executive offices were extraordinarily difficult to move through the Senate, with Republicans holding a razor-thin 51-49 majority, Rosenstein breezed to confirmation as Deputy Attorney General by the margin of 94-6, with overwhelming hashtag resistance support. Yet, on Comey's firing, he badly misdiagnosed the Democrats. So this is where the Democrats say, well, why would you fire Comey? He's clearly trying to obstruct justice. And this is just a great spectacle these days, May 9th to May 17th. Rosenstein, he says, well, yeah, President Trump, you do look kind of bad for firing the FBI director. Why would you do that? Why would you fire him? Everyone knew he wrote this memo, but you see Rosenstein here trying to really be a law unto himself or trying to please the Democrats. He wants to appease and appease. So he says, yeah, that looks like obstruction of justice. He opens an investigation into the president for obstruction of justice. So you've got an investigation now going into the president because he fired the FBI director by the Attorney General, the Deputy Attorney General's recommendation. And now you have a week here, and this right here, when you hear obstruction of justice against, when you hear that charge laid against President Trump, this is where that began. He's trying to stop the investigation. He's worse than Nixon, so on and so forth. This is where that accusation is born. And it was fabricated. Comey needed to be fired. Now you move forward to May 16th, 2017. Jim Comey is now leaking his memos of his conversations with the president. He is leaking these memos to the press. And then on May 16th, the New York Times writes all of these writes its main article about President Trump telling Jim Comey to apparently drop the investigation of Mike Flynn. So at that stage, Mike Flynn, he's not a member of the executive branch anymore. He's resigned. This is the president's Department of Justice. He directs it. He is permitted to tell the Department of Justice, go easy on him. He didn't even tell Comey, stop the investigation. He just said, go easy on him. He's a good guy. Jim Comey walks away from that. Well, I think that was a directive from the president. He clearly wants me to, or he's clearly trying to obstruct justice. He just directed me to stop an investigation. Comey leaks these memos to the press, hoping that it will trigger a special investigation against the president for trying to obstruct justice. So he had to set it up in a way. He had to make it look like the president was trying to stop an investigation and that his own Department of Justice was not capable of carrying out this investigation because, look, he's trying to stop us. He fired Comey. He told me to drop the Michael Flynn case. And then so Rosenstein comes in here the day after that New York Times piece on May 17th and says, I am appointing Robert Mueller to lead a special investigation. And he really doesn't put a limit on what Mueller can investigate. He says he will continue the ongoing Russia investigation and anything that comes of it or is related to it. This was very satisfying for the Democrats who got what they wanted. They now have this ongoing investigation into the president. They don't hold power in any of the other branches. Jim Comey got the special counsel he was trying to do. He was trying to trigger. Rod Rosenstein falls back into the good graces of the Democrats and the Never Trumpers. And is it any wonder that the president of the United States looks at this and says, where's the crime? This is a hoax. This is a witch hunt. They are looking for crimes. No one to this day can say what he did wrong. What is the crime they're investigating? And this is why you hear all about, you know, Rosenstein. Well, Trump should just fire him. Get him out of the way. And I think it's very ironic now that suddenly, you know, the Mueller probe is winding down. Well, that's convenient that it happens right after the Democrats win the House of Representatives back and can now take the lead on these investigatory committees like the House Judiciary Committee, the House Intelligence Committee. They now have control to constitutionally investigate the president, the executive branch, the way it was set up to do. But for those 2 years there, they needed some way not to prosecute, but to persecute the president and those around him. That's why I say this is not ethical. This is why McCarthy says maybe it's constitutional, but it's not ethical the way this is being conducted. Where's the crime? What are they looking for? Well, as we've heard a lot about on this show over the past months, they haven't found any evidence of Russian collusion. They've created crimes by entrapping people to lie. They've dug up crimes from 10 or 15 years ago. They've scared a lot of people by carrying out early morning raids of their homes. They have the president upset with them. And this is where we are today. There's this check, this thorn in the side of the president. And it really, when you look at the details, that investigation is based on what we've been talking about for over a year now, or maybe just since the start of this year. It's based on the Steele dossier. We'll go ahead and open a counterintelligence investigation and try to figure out if any of this is true. And look at the division that has come from that sort of decision. And a lot of this is here because men are more concerned about their reputations. They want to, you know, please both sides. But then, as Mr. Gerald Fleury has said, this is a calculated assault. It is the deep state, and they are working to bring this president down. The Federalist Society, I just want to conclude with a couple more sound bites from this video they made. This is another fantastic video. It's about 20 minutes long. It's called To Seek Justice, Defining the Power of the Prosecutor. You could just go on YouTube and go to the Federalist Society and watch this video if you want. It's incredibly fascinating, but it talks about the power of the prosecutor in the United States government. It's really helpful to help you understand what Robert Mueller is up to, what a prosecutor does. I'll just play a couple of clips from this to conclude with a couple remarks after each one.
I see that the prosecutor as wielding the most enormous power of any government official, when you think about it. And I'm talking about exercising legitimate power that can deprive a person of his liberty, destroy a person's reputation, and actually take away a person's life in those jurisdictions that have capital punishment.
So it's a very powerful position that Robert Mueller is in, and there aren't a lot of checks on it. There's not a lot of ways to rein it in, and as that video explains, you can't sue the prosecutor. He might get a slap on the wrist, but there's nothing to punish him. You know, if he withholds evidence or if he hides evidence that might be helpful to the defendant. There are a couple men on Mueller's team. Andrew Weissman is one of them. He ran an entire corporation out of business by indicting the heads of this corporation, but he withheld evidence from the judge in that case. It didn't matter if he was right or wrong. The indictment is what really led to the closure of that company. 2 years later, this case makes it up to the Supreme Court, and they say this was not presented the first time. This is overruled. This is overturned. He was wrong, and nothing happens. You know, we want them to have that free rein to go and find the crime if they need it. We'll just conclude with a couple more clips here.
People always tell me, it may not be a perfect system, but it's the best system that we've devised. And I always tell them, you know, conceptually, I agree with that. But if this is the best, then then that's frightening. Because all you have to do is hang out in any courthouse for any period of time in virtually any jurisdiction, and you would be appalled by what you see on a daily basis.
That's a very revealing clip there, and again, like I said earlier, it should make us very thankful that there are answers, that there is a better system of government. And a lot of these men think, well, if we just keep debating about it, we'll eventually find the system that works. And that just isn't true. What would happen and what is needed is for us to just be humble enough to look at what God says and to set it up His way, to do things the way He instructs, to judge according to His law. And I'll just conclude with one of my favorite scriptures here. It's 2 Chronicles 19, verse 5 through 6. And this is talking about King Jehoshaphat of Judah. And he set judges in the land throughout all the fenced cities of Judah, city by city, and said to the judges, "Take heed what you do, for you judge not for man, but for the Lord, who is with you in the judgment. Take heed, be careful how you judge. Make sure you understand the law and realize you're not doing this for any man. You're not doing this for your own biases or to please any man. You judge according to the Lord, according to His law." We'll go ahead and just leave it there. Thank you very much for listening. Mr. Fleury should be back doing a couple programs next week. If you have any comments for the show, you can email those to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for listening.